And that is Julius, who's our tech support guy.
Yep. And then starting the live stream to YouTube now.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. I will call the Subcommittee on Minnesota Water Policy to order at this point in time. Casey, if you could take the roll, please.
Senator Dreheim. Senator Dreheim. Senator Eaton.
Here.
Senator Eakin. Senator Eakin. Senator Goggin. Senator Goggin. Senator Weber.
Here.
Senator Wieger. Senator Wieger. Representative Brand.
I am here.
Chair Fisher.
Present.
Representative Heintzman. Representative Heintzman. Representative Lippert.
Here.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Torkelson.
Here.
And yes, you have quorum.
All right. Thank you, Casey. We will get started with the first item on the agenda then, which is approval of the subcommittee minutes from March 9th, 2020. Would somebody like to move approval of the minutes?
So moved. Sure.
Senator Eakin moved. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes stand approved. Next item we have on the agenda is the future of drinking water report. I will turn it over to Director Stark to get us started on that. One of the things I would like to remind our committee members of is that as you have questions, please make sure to hit the raise your hand function. And then as we get the opportunity, we will then get to your question. With that, Executive Director Stark, go ahead and take it away.
Mr. Chair and members, it's good to see your faces. It's been quite a while since we've had the opportunity to meet. We have more to talk about today than we have time, so we will get right to it. I really appreciate you being here. The first presentation this afternoon is a report on the future of drinking water. Dr. Peter Kalau from the University of Minnesota, the Humphrey Institute, will present. That report was authorized and funded by the Department of Health. The Humphrey Institute and the Water Resources Center participated on that process, which Peter, I think, was a year or so long. I participated in the stakeholder group. This is a very comprehensive report that looks at the future of our drinking water, the threats, the things that the legislature and the agencies need to be thinking about to keep our water safe. So with that, Peter, I will turn this over to you.
Thank you. Just excuse me a minute while I try and share screen. Be able to see that now. Jim, can you just confirm that you can see?
Yes, it's good.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you to the chair and members for giving us this.
Up to 10 turns.
Okay.
Then you got to go to the phone line.
Thank you for giving us this opportunity to tell you about our report on the future of drinking water here. A framework for managing risk. As Jim said, it was commissioned by the MDH, and the team that did the work was from the University of Minnesota, myself, Peter Kalo from Humphrey School, Anne Lewandowski and Lucy Levers from Water Resources Center, and Eileen Kirby, who was a very, very important technical assistant. Our charge was essentially to try and identify opportunities for MDH to better manage risks of drinking water put it in that way, because NDH is actually recognized internationally and nationally for leadership in this drinking water area. So we're building on strength. We concentrated on public water systems, paid little attention to private wells, as you'll see. We did it by reviewing the literature and also looking at what's going on in other jurisdictions, both home and abroad. And as Jim said, our recommendations were informed by an expert panel, a small group of scientists and stakeholders. Jim was a member of the stakeholder group, and they represented interests from consumers to suppliers. The key challenges as we see them for drinking water within this state really involve systems facing an increasing array of potential contaminants, and not just from the usual culprits, agriculture, industry, from us as well, because as the population gets older, we'll use more drugs. They can get out into the environment and into drinking water systems, and because of the way they work, they have bad effects at very low concentrations. As you all know, the systems that we're talking about are complex. Drinking water systems are complex and in parts aging, so there are infrastructural challenges. There are going to be more and more extreme weather events as a result of climate change, and that's going to exacerbate contamination. Another kind of problem, but nevertheless an important one, declining populations in rural communities, which means that they find it hard to actually cover the costs of cleanup. And then a challenge that we didn't have when we started, but we certainly have now, and that is what we describe as the pandemic policy paralysis for all except COVID. And I'll have a bit more to say about in a minute. Our core recommendation, though, was to focus on developing good governance system that can respond in an integrated and flexible fashion to all these emerging challenges, and do so, and this is really important, in a way that commands public confidence. What we said in the report was that we should be, the state should take this opportunity to develop a new drinking water plan. And I put a question mark by that now, because clearly that will be overshadowed by COVID. But what we would want to say is that many of the previous public health problems have actually centered on drinking water. So we need to be tuned to these vulnerabilities. We don't want another kind of Flint failure to complicate what is a very complicated public health situation that we have at present anyway. The rationale for focusing on governance sounds a bit boring, I guess. Governance is about institutional arrangements, policy delivery. The rationale is that without it, even the best intentions for investments in infrastructure or for optimizing management from risk from tap through to source are likely to founder. We need good systems, we need good people. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development has recognized the importance of water in national economies and the importance of good governance, and has put together advice which focuses on being effective, efficient, and commanding public trust. And we've used those building blocks as a basis for developing a governance assessment framework for drinking water in this state. And we've also, we use it to look at where the system is in terms of where are the gaps and where we need to go in terms of future developments. We also use this as a basis for surveying key people in MDH and our own experts and stakeholders. And the question that we ask is how well they thought this state did with regard to governance criteria. But we've got a lot of information back from that. It's all documented within the report itself. Here, I simply want to draw attention to three headline conclusions. The one is a need for more obvious integration. Another is a need for more credible involvement of the public affected. And the third is a need for more effective and creative ways of covering costs in these sparsely populated areas. Go through these one by one quickly. on the integrated approach, there's certainly a perception out there in the public that there's separation rather than integration in the system here. Not surprisingly, because there are a large number of agencies involved, more than seven, and they have split statutory responsibilities. We're assured by the agencies that the legacy amendment has catalyzed interaction, but that needs to be made more explicit for the sake of public confidence. And this is where you come in. We think it should be underpinned by statutes that clarify responsibility and bases them on this important ethic of providing safe and sufficient drinking water for all in a way that respects the environment. How far you should go down this route of unification, and we haven't excluded anything in the report, including the development of a single agency for water or drinking water, that seems unlikely in present circumstances. But how far you should go should really be based on looking at costs, benefits, and equity delivery. Minimally, we believe that we need a coordinating body, and whether or not that's based on current institutions like EQB, or you develop a system de novo, again, depends on looking at costs and benefits. On public involvement, there's a lot of information out there from MDH and others, education information, but we want to go beyond that. We want to empower, not just inform, because through empowering, you get people more involved in making public values to make decisions. To do this, I think you need to have a more engaged critical communities and leaders, give them a voice in all aspects of drinking water, from strategic responses to the governance assessment framework and to acute challenges which turn up from time to time. An interesting area that bears some consideration is, as technology increasingly allows, get them, i.e. the public, involved in monitoring and managing within the home. And that should surely sharpen views about the importance of drinking water decisions and policy. On challenges of covering costs, and here one response to this, it's not the only one, is to consider consolidation of rural suppliers. But do this, again, on the basis of critical appraisal of affordability. It's going to vary from place to place and time to time, dependent upon demographics and other things. And compare this with the needs in terms of technology needs and its costs. Where there are gaps, can those gaps be handled in terms of reorganization of the system? Also here, there's an urgent need to consider staffing challenges, because there's brain drain, quite frankly, from those small rural communities. As well as these three headlines, there are a couple of other issues related to looking cost effectively at dealing with all those contaminants that potentially affect drinking water. And there's a message here for MDH: continue to prioritize contaminants of emerging concern for attention and action on the basis of sound science. They do this, but we think that could be even more sharply done by using more specific comparative risk assessment. Moreover, if you're moving towards a statutory control of those chemicals of emerging concern, then that needs, we think, a cost-benefit analysis. There's a message for suppliers, and that is that contamination is going to vary from place to place, dependent upon geology, dependent upon other polluting sources. And really, how you monitor and manage should reflect those changes. And this is really at the heart of what are referred to as water safety plans that have been advocated by WHO, if I dare mention that international organization in the United States. But anyway, it has. This kind of approach is likely to be, a flexible approach, is likely to be more cost effective than what we're doing at present, but is challenged, frankly, by the inflexibility of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And also by a need for expertise. The more flexibility you have, the more expertise you need. That really needs looking at carefully, and we've suggested developing pilots involving real actors with MDH managing it. Also, not to forget those private wells. You all know that MDH has a statutory authority over siting only. The rest is left to the owners of those private wells. NVH puts out a lot of good information as advisory information, but quite frankly, it's generally ignored because it's well known that private well owners, for various reasons, are not good at monitoring and managing their own water supplies. So we heard a lot of enthusiasm for revisiting, and this again brings in your group, a statutory requirement for testing at sale of property, which would minimally provide a basis in a point in the life history of property safety of water supply, but also would send, we think, a powerful signal that the safety of well water in private wells is an important issue. And finally, moving to conclusions, the conclusions are basically that good governance provides the foundations, make it obviously integrated. It isn't integrated enough at present, at least obviously so. It needs to engage the public as partners. It needs to address the small challenges, these the financial challenges of small communities. We need to look at using comparative risk assessment, sound science and cost benefit analysis for regulating contaminants of emerging concern. We need to explore advantages and drawbacks of those water safety plans, which are tailored to local hazards and are likely to be more cost effective than what we're doing at present, and revisit private wells. That's my presentation, Chairman and members. I'd just, in finale, like to thank the team, the university team, for the support that they've given me in developing today's presentation, and also to thank NVH, who has been professionally based organization that didn't mind our intrusions. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Callow. I appreciate that. I see hands going up here. First person we have is Representative Heintzman. Go ahead, Mr. Heintzman, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had noticed during the presentation, I think it was the third to last slide, that some of the information was based on, I think, recommendations or findings from the World Health Organization. And, you know, recently the World Health Organization has certainly come under fire, a lot of question marks. I'm wondering, does the presentation author consider the information used in this discussion to be 100% credible, or are there question marks maybe in this particular area as the World Health Organization was cited?
I don't think there are, the World Health Organization is a broadly based body. It's an international body. It has come under fire with regard to its response to COVID, but it has a bigger role than that in public health circles. I think the advice here in terms of the development of drinking water safety plans is, in our view, extremely helpful, because it moves towards developing a flexible approach to the contaminants as they occur within different parts of the system. To use the Safe Drinking Water Act requirements of measuring everything all the time waste time and resources, to be quite frank. So I think that the WHO here have actually got the right message, irrespective of the fact that they might not have got it in other areas. But a good, important question. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Heintzman, any other questions?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention, I appreciate the clarification relative to this particular issue, because I do see a lot of question marks relative to the WHO and their credibility, as there seems to be creeping political concerns creeping into their findings, and I hope that it's strictly based on the science. So I appreciate the clarification.
Thank you. Yep.
All right. Next on the list, we have Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kahlo, I hope I'm saying your name right.
That's exactly right. Thank you.
I was a little confused when you were talking about private wells and when a property is sold. Is it currently in statute that the well has to be tested? Because every time I've had a transaction on a property, the well has always been tested. And I guess maybe right now that's just because the buyer wants that. It's not in statute.
Thank you for that question, Representative Boston. And my understanding, and it's a kind of, I'm fairly convinced that it isn't in statute.
Okay.
It is not carried out on a voluntary basis currently, and it's not always carried out. So there was a lot of enthusiasm for developing a statute, because this would be a fairly easy way to address this problem, at least partially, and also send this important message that I was talking about.
Very good. Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Point, Mr. Chairman. Senator Weber here.
Yes, Senator Weber. Go ahead. Very quickly. Representative Torkelson was before yours, but if it's to this point, go ahead, sir.
I would just mention that a lot of times your lenders are also requiring that as a element in their loan process, and actually what I see as a real estate broker is that the public is much more aware and knowledgeable nowadays as it relates to that particular issue. And so as our lenders, quite frankly, in their underwriting capabilities.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Anything else, Representative Poston, on your question?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Next we'll go to Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kahlo, for your presentation. A couple of quick questions. One, we've been hearing a bit, you mentioned COVID in your presentation. We've been hearing a bit about the potential of detecting the virus in wastewater. Did any comments on that?
Yes, I think there are a number of research programs, both here and abroad, US and the UK, looking at this. Certainly virus particles from COVID have been picked up in wastewater. The idea, I think, Representative Torkelson, is to use that as a basis, as maybe a quick and easy basis for identifying where there may be hotspots. So far as I understand it, there are no kind of concerns about exposures from that, at least in terms of after it's released from the sewage treatment works. Within works, there may be issues that need looking at. And I think these studies, and I say the big studies in both the States and the UK on this, these studies should help clarify that.
Very interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could ask a second question.
Please go right ahead, Representative Torkelson.
And this is a little bit of hyperbole, or I don't know what the right term is, but is there any potential to set up a portable testing van, so to speak, that could go right to a site or number of sites and test water on the spot? You know, one of the problems with submitting water samples is getting them collected and transported properly. And this way, in that fashion, you could just go out there, test the water, and give the results instantly to the well owner.
Well, thank you for that again, Representative Torkelson. I kind of not a chemist an environmental scientist of that kind, so I can't answer definitively. And if you'd like, we should probably come back to you on this from other university sources. But it seems to me that the kind of analytical procedures that are used in this assessment of quality of water. And, I mean, they're not kind of very demanding. I say this without knowing too much about it. But if that is the case, then why not? Why not have portability? And indeed, I thought that in certain places I've come across portable systems. But we'll come back to you on that, Professor, Representative Torkelson, with a more authoritative response.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, many of these wells go untested for decades. Mm-hmm. And if we could have some kind of a systematic approach to well testing, even if it took a 10-year cycle, as we're doing with some of our water yeah. sampling efforts, it might well be worth it.
Agree.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Executive Director Stark.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, to address your question, that certainly is possible. It depends a bit on the analytes that you're looking for. Even organic compounds, for example, are capable of being tested in the field. It's a matter of efficiency. It certainly could be done. Certainly for indicator compounds, for example, nitrate chloride, that could be done efficiently and well in the field in a mobile lab.
Chairman, if I could just add one.
Go ahead, Mr. Callow.
Further observation, and that is that as we move the technology and we move towards more use of high tech, then I think that the miniaturization of analytical processes, our hope is that those kinds of processes to some extent might be done by the inexpert in their own homes, and that, as we mentioned within the report, would certainly drive people's interest in drinking water quality.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Callow. Any other questions that anyone may have? I'm not seeing any hands. I've got a quick question or two, or hopefully quick question, Mr. Callow. In terms of when you folks are taking a look at the water quality, water issues that are out there, how often does the old lead service pipes, by the service pipes, I mean the pipes running from the homes out to the main lines, how prevalent is that out there? And is there a pattern of where they might be found? In other words, is it more common in older communities that might be rural versus in-state? And how large is that problem?
Yeah, no, it is a problem. And it is certainly more prevalent in older property. And together with the MDH, and this was driven largely by MDH, we made a contribution. We wrote a report about that lead in drinking water in this state in association with this Future of Drinking Water report. And that is available on the MDH site and talks about the costs and the benefits of doing something about lead contamination. The costs are very considerable over the state. I haven't got the figures to mind, but the benefits are even more considerable in terms of avoiding issues like reduced IQ. So that report is available and you can access it through the MDH.
All right, awesome, thank you. And then the other question I had is, this goes back to one of your earlier slides on the integrated approach addressing water issues. Is one of the things that had been mentioned is minimally need a coordinating body for overseeing some of this. Is when you mentioned that, what were the thoughts, what were the suggestions coming out of that? Was it like trying to bring all the different governmental agencies into one? What were the thoughts?
Well, the thoughts are that integration is really important when you're dealing with such a complex, interconnected system as drinking water. And that the lack of integration carries with it some risks in terms of problems falling between agencies. The agencies are now working together, they tell us, much more effectively as a result of the legacy amendment. But we believe, if only for the sake of public confidence, and there isn't confidence here, that there is a truly integrated approach, that integration needs to be effected. And we didn't exclude anything here, even the thought about a single agency for water or drinking water. And that's, but being realistic, I think COVID is going to undermine all that kind of consideration. So minimally, we think you need to have, we need to have, a coordinating body. and that is backed by statutes. And those statutes actually define responsibilities and base it on this ethic of providing safe and sufficient drinking water for all while respecting the environment. This really is key to developing an integrated approach. And our thoughts on how you do that is really, well, minimally you need something, some organization that coordinates. EQB does some kind of job in that respect. There are other bodies, as you're aware, that do similarly. But I think we should look at the relative advantages and drawbacks of following out these various approaches and consider whether or not developing something de novo might actually send an important signal that this is an area that needs attention. So that's as far as we got. What we said was you need to do it sooner rather than later in terms of this coordinating body. But what you do really depends upon looking at advantages and drawbacks, and that involves all kinds of considerations, not just scientific ones.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kahlo. I don't see any other questions at this point in time. I will turn it over to Executive
Mr. Chair
for our next part of the presentation here.
Thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Clough. Really appreciate it. I just want to say a couple of words about this report. It's very comprehensive. It's very thorough. I will send you a link to the report. But in addition, I've spent quite a bit of time with it, and I've boiled it down to what I think are about 8 points that you might want to consider with respect to legislation, from at least from my perspective, that come out of that report. And that should be in your packages. I will send that to you again. And I hope that we can meet again in a month or so and talk specifically about those 8 items. So that's pared down to several pages. I think it's concise. The group that worked on the report has looked at it and at least have told me that I haven't said anything untoward there. But they may not agree with all those suggestions or back them as recommendations. But I hope we can talk about that in the near future. So thank you. And that should be in your package. I'll send it to you again. Next, we want to talk about the Upper Mississippi River Basin. And the presentations today will be by staff from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Dan Stewart, Megan Lennon are here with us. They're going to talk about watershed tools being used in the Upper Mississippi, watershed protection tools. I think in particular, the Upper Mississippi, and you can think of that sort of as above the metro, it depends a bit on how you define it. But I think we have a really great opportunity in the Upper Mississippi to protect those waters. We're well underway in terms of the amount of land that needs to be protected. The DNR has estimated that if you can protect in some way, primarily, you know, forests, but in other ways, 60% of the land, you can protect and preserve the quality of those waters. I think with the legacy clean water, LaSarge SAMS programs, as well as federal programs, including forests, we're almost there in that part of the Upper Mississippi. And I think there's an excellent opportunity to demonstrate that the legacy amendments have really addressed that issue in the Upper Mississippi, protecting those waters and also protecting source waters for the metro. So we need a little bit of accounting, a little bit of work to put those programs and the lands they've preserved together, and so that we understand totally how much has been protected and preserved. But we're very close, I think, in the Upper Mississippi. And with that, that's a little bit of my introduction and where I think we need to go as a state to demonstrate the work that's been done by the amendments. But with that, I'll turn this over to Dan Stewart and to Megan Lennon to talk about some of the work that's been done there.
Okay, Dan. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stark. And then to Mr. Stewart or Ms. Lennon, whoever would like to start first, if you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself and start with the presentations.
Great, thank you. This is Megan Lennon, and I just want to start off and say thank you to Chair's members and to Director Stark for inviting Bowser to present today. I'm Bowser's legislative coordinator, and I'm just going to give a really brief description of Bowser's role in coordinating watershed planning and protection as a way to frame Mr. Stewart's presentation. So currently, Bowser is evolving from a county-based local watershed water plans to comprehensive watershed management plans. And these comprehensive watershed management plans align on major watershed boundaries in the state. And Minnesota is leading this effort through the One Watershed, One Plan program. And in One Watershed, One Plan plans, local governments and partners in the watershed collaborate towards implementing prioritized, target, and measurable conservation activities. Partners include counties, soil and water conservation districts, and watershed districts, and they develop watershed plans with input from state agencies, citizens, businesses, lake associations, ag groups, nonprofits, and other partners. And Bowser assists these local governments in developing One Watershed, One Plan plans by providing planning grants. Bowser oversees watershed planning processes. We provide watershed-based implementation funding, other competitive grants, as well as other tools for targeting. And my colleague, Mr. Stewart, will now walk you through how Bowser is working with partners on watershed planning in the Upper Mississippi River Basin. And I will pull up his presentation.
Okay, Mr. Stewart, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm really thank you, Megan, for that introduction. I just want to make a few comments today about some of the great work that's going on, and primarily in the area of forest conservation and the Upper Mississippi watershed. Next slide, please. Thank you. A little context on the Upper Mississippi. It's a huge basin. As Jim said, starting at the Twin Cities and going all the way up to Lake Itasca, covering these parts for all 35 counties. It's the only basin that's entirely within the state of Minnesota. So we are uniquely responsible for the condition of the Mississippi as it flows down to Iowa and Wisconsin and below. There's 525 miles of the river main stem in the upper basin. A great scale there. It represents a map question mark in shape. 7,500 plus lakes within that watershed, within that basin, which is a tremendous number of lakes. That's the largest source water in Minnesota, too, if you count it by volume and by population served. Next slide, please. The Upper Mississippi Basin is complex. It's easiest to get a handle on, I think, if we start with the tributaries. The map on the right, you can see if we start at the bottom there at the south end with the Crow River on the west, coming in from the west side, largely agricultural watershed, and then the Sauk River coming in above that, and then the orangish watershed is Crow Wing River. The colors here, the background colors show the percent of protected forest land. Okay, so you start with the prairie area and being mostly ag being red as you move north progressively green as we move into the forest. Okay, and so then there's the Pine River watershed, that relatively small one, and then above that, the Leech Lake River watershed. And then around the only major tributary coming to the Mississippi, the upper basin from the east side. And that's primarily because there just is room on the east side of the river to develop large rivers because their watersheds aren't big enough. Whereas on the west side, there's enough room because Mississippi makes that big swing east over the Grand Rapids. So then if we look at what's left, we can see these to be, we call them bilateral flow throughs. The smaller streams and rivers that were too small to have a major watershed. And so they're kind of clumped together starting with Mississippi Headwaters at the top, then Mississippi Grand Rapids.
Mr. Chair.
Go, excuse me, Mr. Stewart. If you can hold on a second here, I think we're having a little problem hearing. I'm having trouble understanding you, and I think some of the others are having the same issue.
Mr. Chair, possibly Megan would volunteer to take over. Dan is in Brainerd. I know the connection isn't super there. Megan, are you willing to do that?
Megan, you're muted. You're muted, Megan.
Maybe we could have Dan try to adjust his microphone. The connection should be very good in Brainerd. It shouldn't be an issue, but.
Yeah, this is Megan. Someone unmuted me. Thank you. Dan, if maybe you could get closer to the computer mic. Dan is the premier expert on this topic.
I'm trying the headset too.
Still a little, sounds, try again. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay. I've got the headset on now as well.
Still sounding so kind of garbled, Mr. Stewart.
We still have
it's yeah. Still garbled. Yes, you're still coming across pretty garbled.
Okay, that's too bad. If Megan has to take over, that's fine. She'll do a great job. I look forward to some other time, perhaps.
Okay, I think that we might have to go to backup plan here. Number two on that is, I know that Mr. Stewart, you're very knowledgeable on it, but it's very hard to understand. And so if we could maybe have Ms. Lennon try to cover part of it, have you on to try to help coax it through, and maybe a little bit later in the presentation, maybe the sound may improve. But right now, it's very difficult for people to understand.
Yeah, this is Megan. I can take off where Dan left off, but maybe Dan, could you try calling in on your phone? Maybe that would have a better audio connection.
Mr. Chair, I think we should go ahead and give Dan a second to try and do that. See if he can call in.
Okay.
And we can just stand by for a minute and see if that works. Because Dan, I've heard this presentation before and it's very good.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Why don't we go ahead and try that, Mr. Stewart, if you'd like to go ahead and call in on the phone and see if we can get a better connection that way.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Stark.
I can fill in here for a moment if as we wait. When Dan is available, we'll just move on. But I think we have just a wonderful opportunity in the Upper Mississippi to show what the amendments for the environment have done to protect our water and to protect our source water. It's just a great opportunity here for this area to serve as the poster child for down the road a few years when we need to put the message out to the citizens of the state that these dollars have been well spent and have done well. I think we're nearly there in this watershed. We just need to do a little bit of accounting. For example, the Lassard Sams outdoor heritage programs that put easements on land sometimes aren't recognized with respect to the improvements that they provide for water quality. So we need to account for those. We need to make sure we're accounting for all the federal protected land that we have in this area, and then to bring that message forward to the citizens of the state. I think this is the place where we can do that most efficiently. We could also look at the Lake Superior Basin or the St. Croix. But if we have to choose one particular watershed, I think this is a great opportunity. I've summarized some thoughts about this in your packets. It's in less than a page or less than two pages. And I really hope that we can talk about this and what that might involve and look like as an initiative to really understand what's been done here, the good work that's been done. And I hope, again, we can spend a little more time with that at a next meeting. So as we wait here, I see Dan dialing in. I'll just, Sue, maybe we should continue with your announcement about the SALT Symposium, if you're available.
Executive Director Stark, that's a great suggestion. Ms. Neeson, if you'd like to go ahead and tell us about what's coming up, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Let me share my screen with you guys, Chair Fisher, and let's see. Okay. Is my screen visible?
Yes.
It sure is.
Awesome. Okay. Chair Fisher and members, my name is Sue Nissen. I'm a citizen volunteer. I'm with a group called Stop Oversalting, and we educate in our communities about chloride use. And I'm here today because I wanted to tell you about the Minnesota Salt Symposium. In past years, you're in session when the Salt Symposium is going on. And this year, because of changes and COVID, it's virtual and it's in August. And so I wanted to let you know. For 19 years, this symposium has been going on in the state of Minnesota. And for those 19 years, it's been about de-icing salt. And experts and stakeholders have had just amazing symposiums. I've been to a number of them. And it's all about the efficient use of chloride. It is really wonderful. And what I wanted you to know is this year, it's really being expanded. The number of speakers is doubled. And the conversation is now going to include water softeners, fertilizer, and dust control. So this is a huge change, all big chloride sources in the state of Minnesota. And in conjunction with the symposium, the Minnesota Statewide Chloride Management Plan is going to be unveiled. And that plan is going to be asking everyone in the state of Minnesota to reduce their chloride use. So I just wanted to give you a quick overview. You know, Minnesota is a leader on the topic of chloride. We are the first state to have a symposium, the first state to have a chloride management plan. We're still the only state to have those. And people across the U.S. Are registering for the symposium. They want to know what Minnesota is doing. So here's what they're going to be talking about this year. Keynote speakers are both Minnesotans from the Department of Health. We're going to hear about our chloride sources. And then from MPCA, our statewide chloride coordinator is going to roll out the chloride management plan. And that'll happen at the beginning of each day, but the content for the rest of those days then is varies. And did I just lose my internet connection?
No, you're good.
Okay, good. I'm in outstate Minnesota in Otter Tail County, and it's been going back and forth. So I want to just quickly show you what is going to be happening. I can't get that to go away. Okay, the morning of the first day is all about water softeners, both what's happening at our cities with centralized softening at our homes. It is both speakers from government and from industry. And then in the afternoon, it's all about chloride in fertilizers. So this is with farmers and on our own lawns and the dust suppressants that we're putting on our roads. So this is all the new content for the symposium. This is so bad. I'm sorry, my internet is goofing me up. But anyway, second day of the symposium is the work on roads, and that's the traditional content of the symposium. And I'm going to try and get this up. Here we go. I want to bring this back because I want you to draw to your attention this first speaker. And this is a new salt training for Minnesota. We've traditionally trained our roads people and our parking lot and sidewalk people. And we lead the country in that kind of training. But now we're training our property managers. And why is that important? Because as decisions are made about a property, if the people that are doing the work and are hiring the contractors are on the same page, we are much more likely to have efficient use of our salt. And I've been a part of this. I've sat in on the trainings, and I have sat beside property managers who are there for the first time, and they say, I am going back and I am going to change how we're managing our properties. This is a huge thing. So the rest of the day is going to be all about how do we use less chlorides, and you can see that a lot of it is going to be about liquid, and because liquid's the wave of the future there. So that's what I wanted to let you know. Of course, the goal of this symposium is to use less salt, but on these needed tabs, because chloride does a great job and we need what it does in the state, but we need to be using less. And I want to close by telling you that I'm in rural Otter Tail County on a small lake, and behind me are corn and bean fields that get fertilized and a gravel road that has dust surfactant on it. Around me are 220 properties, most of them with water softeners because we're in an area with very hard water. We have a state road, county, and township roads that touch the sides of this lake. Now, I traditionally thought of chloride as a metro problem because I see it there, but I'm up here and I'm surrounded with chloride. So I think it's great that we're expanding the conversation, that we have a statewide chloride management plan. And I hope you are interested in this and might be able to attend some of the sessions this year. If you are, you can contact Mr. Stark and he can help you with sign up. So if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Neeson. Appreciate the update and what's occurring. It sounds very exciting. I'm not seeing any questions at this point in time. So I would say thank you once again for being here, Ms. Neeson. And then Director Stark, why don't we move back and see how we're doing with Mr. Stewart here to pick up on where we left off on the presentation he had for us.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you, Sue. And if you're interested in this, I will send you the details. If you're interested, I can sign you up. If not, I will report back to you. I'm going to try to be at most of that. So thank you. And I think we have Dan on the phone now. Dan, is that correct? I think you're muted.
He's muted. Does it take, what is it, star 6 to unmute? There we go. Mr.
Okay.
Stewart.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you. Oh, can hear you very clearly, sir.
Excellent.
Why don't you go ahead, Mr. Stewart?
Thank you. So I think we were talking about these online direct Mississippi watersheds stretching from the headwaters at Lake Itasca. They also include many of the northern urban areas, including with Bemidji, Grand Rapids, Brainerd, and then down to Little Falls. And so you can see on that map on the left, the flow-throughs map, the heavy green colors in the north representing heavily forested areas, the Chippewa National Forest, a lot of state forest land, and so on. And then progressively, as we get towards Brainerd, the colors switch to yellow as we get more and more open lands and into the transition zone of the state, and then finally into the reds and oranges that represent, the more furry part of the state. And so, next slide, please. This slide just shows touching base with the One Water, One Plan process, as Megan had talked about. And it's well underway in the upper part of the basin. As you can see, the basin in black there in the central part of the state. The Leach watershed is complete. The Crow is complete. They're One Water, One Plans. The Pine is complete. Headwaters, Red Eye are close to complete. And the Rum is also well underway. So this is very important because it provides a great means for local units to weigh in with their management priorities. And in many cases, they're really tapping into this information through on forestry and the importance of forest cover, and that is a simple means, forest protection, to protecting habitat and water quality. Next slide, please. This is a key slide. This little graph on the inset here represents a tremendous amount of research by DNR Fisheries. And they studied 1,200 fish management lakes in Minnesota. And they were looking for how much conversion of land use from prairie or forest can occur in a watershed before a lake starts to enrich with too much phosphorus. And you can see phosphorus starts to rise dramatically at about a 25% level of deforestation. So this flipped around becomes a very simple, useful goal for lake watersheds. If you can protect 75% of your watershed in forest, you should be able to maintain water quality into the future. This happens to be Borden Lake in Curling County, right by Garrison. And in the background there, you can see Mille Lacs Lake off at the top. And you can see this watershed is mostly forested, but part of it has been opened up and deforested. There's some hay fields there, it looks like. And so this is the process that all of our lakes are going through over the years as the state develops, and there tend to be more and more intrusions into the watershed and more deforestation. Next slide, please. This slide just shows some of the changes in forest cover in the state since roughly 1850. The red line on the left map, or on either map, being the original forest cover, and then you can see the current line much further north, the gold line or yellow line, and in between roughly the area of forest loss. Of course, one thing that's really interesting here is much of the state's lost about a third of its forest acreage. And much of that has occurred right in this area immediately adjacent to the drinking water supply. So it didn't happen at the north end of the basin. It happened at the south side of the upper Mississippi basin. And so this tends to be ongoing. There are many sources of deforestation. And many of them can be things we see useful, but it does come at a cost. Next slide, please. So as a result, the simple message is protect the sponge. And you can see in the graph, in the inset there, that blue arrow pointing down in the center of the sketch, that's the key point right there. Forests infiltrate water into the ground. And that serves as a strongly moderating influence on the whole watershed. It slows the hydrology, the river, the streams, the lakes, everything down. And eventually that water, much of it at least, comes into the lake downstream or into a stream, but it might be months, weeks or months later. And so in the process, the water is cooled and clean. And that's why northern Minnesota has so many high-quality lakes in a nutshell. This is especially true, this forest infiltrate water, where you have sandy soils. And most of north-central Minnesota is dominated with sandy soils. So it's a powerful moderator of watersheds. Next slide. The legislature has provided many tools for forest management for landowners.
Excuse me, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Stewart.
Yes, sir.
I'm hearing a little feedback on your presentation there. I'm wondering, do you still have the microphone on your computer? And if so, if you could mute that, or if Casey, if you're able to mute that one. I think that's where the feedback is coming from.
Okay.
Okay, let's try it. Go ahead, Mr. Stewart.
Okay, let's see.
That sounds better. There we go. We're fine.
Thank you. So this just is showing in a graph, a pyramid form or shape, just a way of making some of the tools that the legislature has provided over the years to encourage landowners to manage and take care of their forest lands. So that they're more understandable for landowners. So you can kind of think of it as starting with stewardship plans at the bottom. Simple, non-threatening, but important information on a person's forest land. And then there's cost share available if you want to plant trees or do various things there. Of course, a timber harvest is available and can be a way of also improving the forest. And then there's the Sustainable Forest Incentives Act, or SFIA. Now we're talking 8, 20, or 50-year covenants to protect and not develop the forests. So this has become a very popular program in the state. And then there's conservation easements, which is permanent protection through the RIM program, or with Bowser, or with DNR's Forest for the Future program, or other easement opportunities. And then in some cases, there is detitled purchase where that fits with locals and things like that. And so this is just a simple way of taking a really complex set of possibilities and making them a little more easy to understand. Next slide, please. Rack storing. What we've done is developed, because there's so many lands and so many lakes and watersheds and so on, we developed a real simple three criteria system for screening parcels, so that what we're looking for here is return on investment, or ROI, on the conservation dollar, so that if we're going to invest some conservation dollars in these watersheds through forest protection, let's do it where we at least arguably get a better buyer for our dollar, that is more return. And so R stands for riparian. We like lands that are riparian. It doesn't have to be a lake. It can be a river or a creek or something like that. We like being adjacent. So A, the second letter in RAC, is for adjacent to already protected lands. They might be county land, state land, Forest Service land, or an existing easement. But if we're next to that, we're making a complex bigger, and lots of habitat types benefit from size. So, and then Q is quality. Perhaps there's wild rice there, or really significant biological diversity of one sort or another, either in the lake or in the land. So we have scores developed for parcels, simple, fast, cheap, easy to run, but it's been quite effective and well-received. And so this arrow here is pointing at a large tract of about 200 acres in Cass County that is adjacent to Cass County land, and the Cass County Land Commissioner is very interested in acquiring that to fit it in with the existing Cass County land base. And so it happened to a rack very high, and is at the top of the watershed where very little can influence it from above, and that's a good thing. So, you know, he can make a pretty good argument in this case, I think, for that being a good return on investment. Next slide, please. I've talked a lot about protection, forest protection, but protection is important to define that word. And it doesn't mean that you can't manage the forest. These are working lands, and so the forests, like the public lands, which are pretty well managed and are audited and under a lot of review on an annual basis, and are by many accounts very well managed. We're looking to extend that also onto the private lands. And so these lands are working lands. They can still produce the landowner some revenue from time to time. The important thing is that they grow back into forests and not converted to some other use. That's the most important thing in underlying our water quality. Next slide, please. I'll close with these last two. This is the Mississippi River Success Story. This project is located, as you can see there, in Brainerd on the map on the left, and Crosby up on the northeast part of the map, roughly. And that minor watershed we're looking at in orange there, that's circled. That orange means it's relatively high risk for deforestation and degradation. 20 to 40% protected land base right now in that watershed. So that's relatively high risk. We were able to move that to 71% in 2 years, from 2017 to 2019, with all the partners working together. And so we were able to skip the yellow color and go all the way to halfway through the green, which is where 71% would be. Next slide, please. This shows us starting at 37%. These dials correspond to those colors you saw for relative risk. That is 37% protected lands at the beginning of this project. The inset map on the right shows that minor watershed with the Mississippi going through the middle of it. The green patch in the lower part of the map, that was a landowner that wanted to sell. They were going to move out of the area, and so they chose to sell. That land fit in well with adjacent state lands, so that was transferred. Trust for Public Land did the acquisition, and that was transferred to DNR Forestry in that case. So that was 9 clicks towards protection to 46. That was followed by the pink parcel in the upper right-hand corner, and that was a rim easement, a conservation easement, state land staying on the tax rolls, but in permanent forest protection. And that was worth 5 clicks to 51%. And then the Sustainable Forest Incentives Act, which I mentioned, is the large gold tract on the other side of the river, the west side of the river. And now you can see the complex starting to really build there. And this particular landowner was interested in the SFIA land. And many of these lands are held for hunting, deer in particular. And so that fit well with their plans. And so for that modest payment, they're willing to put this into a long-term covenant. The final project is also in green. It's the 440s you see kind of on the right hand, on the back, on the other side of the river. And that was also a fee title. And that particular land, after Trust for Public Land had acquired it, that fit into the ownership of the adjacent Crow Wing County land. So that land ended up with Crow Wing County and is administered as county forest land. And so that brought us up to 71%. So this got us pretty excited when we saw that this really can work, and the tools that have been provided to landowners over the years are pretty strong. And when the partners work together like this, it's really interesting what can be accomplished. So with that, I think I've got one closing slide. That's just to show that forests play a very important role in maintaining Minnesota's quality of life, because they do a lot to support our water quality. They also do a lot to support our habitat. And so private forests produce many public benefits. And I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to talk about this important issue and for all the work you've done in the past to provide these tools. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. I notice that Representative Heintzman has his hands up. Mr. Representative Heintzman, if you'd like to go ahead, please. Having trouble hearing you, Representative Heintzman. Still not coming through. Let's try it this time. Okay, you're starting to come through, Representative Heintzman. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to ask quickly or highlight something that Dan and I have talked about on numerous occasions. Maybe Megan can pull up the slide. There's a triangle, I think it's about 4 or 5 back, with some of the pieces that Dan is talking about of watershed support as it comes together. And at the very tip of that slide, yes, right there, thank you, Megan, we see permanent protection as being, I don't know if I said last resort is the best way to state that, but in most cases, permanent protection, I think, is usually public ownership. And Dan and I have talked a lot about that because, as you know, Chair Fisher, I'm probably more, I lean more towards the Representative Green sort of philosophy in buying land. And what I love about this presentation is that we're really, really utilizing a huge toolbox of resources to still protect water without taking land off the tax rolls, in many cases, managing it and including timber harvest as a part of that healthy forest plan. To me, that's a really exciting concept, and it's not a new one. It's something, though, that I think Dan has done a great job of pulling all the pieces together
in this presentation to provide a kind of a really effective shotgun approach to for solving some of our problems. And here in Crow Wing County, they've demonstrated that with close partnerships with Bowser, our local Soil and Water Conservation Office, and other groups. And if you ever want to sit down and have an amazing conversation, Dan's your guy, because we can talk about everything from wolves to water quality. It's really a fun opportunity to stop by his office.
Awesome. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you for that, Mr. Chair. And I'm sure we'll be talking to Dan and to a number of folks at Bowser about this plan in the years to come.
All right. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Next on the list, we have Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your presentation, Dan. It's a very, very interesting and nice way to look at this in a real basic format. I guess, and I'm not trying to be critical, I'm just curious, you know, I know that all farm fields are not created equal. I'm guessing that not all forests are created equal either. Any delineation between different types of forests and different types of ag use that you look at when you put these evaluations together?
Mr. Stewart, go ahead, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, good question. When we write these forest landscape plans for these One Water, One Plans, as they're getting started, we just provide a bunch of forestry information to the best of our ability. We focus on two things, two goals. One, forest protection, which we talked about, forest conservation, if you prefer. And then the second one is forest management. And that's where there's information as to what was the original forest there. In other words, let's try to get the right trees on the right site whenever we can. I know it's not that simple sometimes and requires time and so on and investment, but that information is provided as well, and it'll be the second phase, I would say, of this overall effort. Is first we've kind of been focusing on forest protection. Let's make sure that at least there's going to be a forest there. And then as we work into this relationship with landowners, a cooperative relationship through that stewardship planning process, let's see how much we can move the forests, if they need to be moved at all, towards what's supposed to be there. And in most cases, that'll be a more diverse forest, I would think, with probably a little more conifer than on the landscape than we have now.
Representative Torkelson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Mr. Stewart. And along the same lines, when land is developed, the way it's developed also can have impacts on water quality. And we don't need to go any further right now, but it all needs to be part of the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Torkelson, Representative Torkelson. Any further questions? I'm not noticing any other hands. Mr. Stewart and Ms. Lennon, thank you so much for the presentation today. Very informative, learned a few things, and we appreciate it. I'll turn it over back to Director Stark for the next part here.
Mr. Chair,
hold it. Who else? Did I hear somebody else ask?
Mr. Chair, Dan, if I could?
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Stewart.
Just thank you so much for bearing with me as we got the technology to work.
Oh, you're welcome, sir. It's something we're used to on these Zoom meetings here. Appreciate your sticking to it and finishing the presentation. Very, very much appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go ahead, Director Stark.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. And I know, Dan, this is his short presentation. He has one that's in much more depth, but I want to thank him and all the speakers. I think the Upper Mississippi is an opportunity for us to really demonstrate the good work that the environmental amendments have done. And I think it's a great story and would be a great tool for us to use when those amendments need to be reapproved. In your packets, you have a 1.5 page summary of a program that I'd like us to discuss in more depth. I hope we can have an opportunity to do that. In addition, in your packets is a draft strategic plan for this committee. So I've spent some time thinking about, you know, what direction we have to be going in, what should guide us, and I hope you'll take a look at that. So I'm hoping that we can spare another hour of your time in August to focus in more detail on the things we've talked about today, specifically as they might relate to legislation. So, Mr. Chair, do you think we can have another Zoom meeting like this in mid-August to focus a little more detailed on the things we've talked about today?
Thank you, Director Stark. I would imagine that people would probably be interested in that. Maybe if we could get a quick show, if you guys could, if the committee attendees could use the raise their hand function to see if we could get a idea how people might feel about having a mid-August meeting. If you could just raise your hand real quick so we could see how that might work. I would say from what I'm seeing here, we would definitely have a quorum. And would make sense because if we're going to start teeing up anything for session next year, that's usually about the time we want to start talking about and start laying out plans. So a mid-August one would probably make a lot of sense. Other questions that you might have at this point in time, and everyone can go ahead and lower their hands at this point.
So Mr. Chair and members, thank you. That's what I was looking for today. I want us to have some more detailed discussion about these things. So I would anticipate an hour and a half meeting sometime. I'll try to find a time that works best. I'll work through your LAs and see what your calendars are like. And I think that would be very beneficial.
All right.
Other issues? If you have any other issues that you'd like me to look into or are concerned about in your districts, let me know. I'd be happy to do that. And with that, I just thank the speakers. Thanks for your attention and your attendance. I really appreciate the support we have here today. And thanks. We worked through a few little technical bugs, but it went pretty well. Thanks to Casey and to Julius as well for being behind the scenes here.
Thank you, Director Starr. Thank you, Julius. Thank you, Casey, for helping run a meeting, our meeting today, a good meeting. We appreciate it. Before we adjourn, does anyone have any other issues or anything that they'd like to bring up at this point in time? I'm not seeing any hands go up. So at this point, I will declare that we are adjourned. Thank you all for making it. Thank you to all the speakers who are here today. Appreciate everyone being part of it. Have a great
week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.